So for those of you who know my middle child, my second son, Charlie, you will know that he is the fearless one. Every parent has that child, you know, that whose fearlessness causes you so much fear. And that's Charlie. If we can get him to bed without any major injuries, we've had a good day. That's what I tell Abby. Just keep him alive and pray for him. But there's one thing that absolutely terrifies my Charlie: a vacuum cleaner. It's like his kryptonite. He'll fight his brother, who's twice his size. He'll jump downstairs without fear. He'll play with spiders. But you plug in a Hoover, and he comes undone. And yesterday, he dropped his plate, made a mess. I had to clean it up. So I left the room to get the vacuum, and he's kind of trailing along behind me, pleading with me not to get the vacuum and plug it in. And I just said, you know, Charlie, I have to use the vacuum. I'm sorry. So he does what he does every time. He runs to the corner of the furthest room, puts those fingers in his mouth, and just begins to suck furiously until I'm done vacuuming. And then when I'm done vacuuming, I have to literally spend a few minutes with him, calming him down, telling him everything's going to be okay, reassuring him. And I've tried to tell him repeatedly that it's just not that big of a deal. It's a vacuum cleaner. There's nothing to fear, but it doesn't matter. In his little mind, a vacuum cleaner is the worst nightmare he could imagine. As we approach our text this morning, I want us to consider, is it possible that our greatest fears, our deepest anxieties, the thing that keeps you up at night, things that reduce us to just trembling messes, could it be that those things, from God's perspective, are like Charlie with a vacuum? Could it be that our fears are misguided? That the very thing we fear the most is actually going to be okay. And the things we should fear the most, that we should have a healthy fear of, we don't. Could our fears be disordered? That seems to be what our text is saying this morning. Here's how, I only have 2 points. Here's how I divided. We're going to look at what the disciples thought was their greatest fear. And then we're going to close by looking at what truly is their greatest fear. So what do they think was their greatest fear, and what truly was their greatest fear? Well, let's begin with what they thought they should fear. Verse 37, a great windstorm arose and the waves were breaking into the boat, so the boat was already filling with water. The description is pretty straightforward, but I don't want us to miss the details because they are important. They really set this text apart. They're out on sea and storm rises up. It's so powerful. These are large boats. I don't know what comes to mind for you, but these are large boats. And so these are really powerful waves that are crashing over the sides, and the boat's filling up with water, and it's on the verge of sinking out in the middle of the sea. And the point is this. This is not your day-in, day-out troubles that we all experience. This is the once-in-a-lifetime trouble. This isn't normal fears. This is your worst nightmare. I think, in other words, if we're going to be faithful to the text this morning, if we're going to enter into it how we're supposed to enter into it, then we need to delineate this trial from the normal trials of life. The disciples have troubles in their lives. They have concerns. They have anxieties. They have this in their lives just like the rest of us. But in our text today, they're about to die. Their boat is sinking, and they are moments away from drowning. That's not something that happens every day. And that's the point. Our passage, what's so wonderful about our passage is that it addresses the unique trials of life. Those things that we fear the most. Not the cloudy days, the storm, the eye of the storm. And that's what I want all of us to have in mind as we come to the text. The worst days of your life. The worst imaginable possible scenario. Now, some of you here are there right now. We're laughing and cheering on soccer, and you're thinking, I'm in the storm. I am smack dab in the middle of this storm. You don't have to imagine this text. You're living this text. Some of you here, perhaps some of you here battling depression or anxiety disorders, seem to never escape this text. This is your life. The normal circumstances of life are nearly drowning you every day. Your nightmare is getting out of bed. Some of you, I would say probably the majority of us, are not in this text right now. I mean, maybe it's not a perfect sunny day with no chance of rain, but there may be clouds in the sky or something like that, but we're not in the storm. We're not in the heat of the storm. But make no mistake about it, the storm is coming. I'm sorry. We live in a fallen, broken world. The storm is coming. Eventually, every single one of us will be in this text. In this text. Verse 37 speaks to the darkest hours of our life. If that's you, then you need this passage. If that's not you, then you will need this passage. So let's see. Let's continue on and see how this thing unfolds. Verse 37 sets the context, sets the scene. Verse 38. But he, meaning Jesus, was in the stern asleep on a cushion. Now, of course, the contrast there is unmistakable and intentional. They are terrified, and Jesus is taking a nap. In the heart, in the heat of the storm, Jesus is sound asleep. Now, there are two ways to interpret that. And the disciples interpreted it wrongly, and it's probably the way you typically interpret it. And I interpret it. The rest of verse 38, he's asleep on the cushion, and then look at the rest of verse 38. This is how they interpreted his sleep. They woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" They interpret his sleep as indifference. Do you not care? We're perishing, and you're asleep. Now, that's one way to interpret things, and this is typically how we interpret things. Behind our frustrations and our doubts, and our questioning and our doubting of God, and our accusations towards God, and our panic and our anxiety, lurking behind all of these emotions is a fundamental distrust in the goodness of God. A distrust in His sovereignty, a distrust in His goodness. Do you not care? And from one point of view, I suppose that is a valid accusation. I mean, prayers do go unanswered, so to speak. Circumstances don't get better. When our prayers seem to go unanswered, when our circumstances don't change for the better, when God is silent, our immediate interpretation of God's apparent inactivity is that He doesn't care about our trials. If He did, He would do something. Or He's not there. So God being metaphorically asleep when the storm rages around us could certainly be interpreted as a lack of care, and many of us interpret it that way. But there is another way to view this, you know. There's another way to interpret Jesus asleep during the storm. He's asleep because this isn't a problem at all. He is completely at ease, completely at peace. The storm does not worry him at all. He is so at ease with the circumstances that he decides it would be a good time to take a nap. The message here is that their greatest fear just isn't that big of a deal to him. Now, I don't want to be insensitive. I know that they're hurting here, and I don't want to make light of that, nor does God. But understood rightly, this is actually incredibly reassuring. God's not surprised by your trials. He isn't running around in a panic wondering what can be done. He's okay. And He's okay because everything's okay. You ever been on a flight and the plane starts making weird noises or you hit some crazy turbulence? And what's the first thing you do? You look at the flight attendant. And like, you know, when you see that flight attendant walking around, at ease, like there's nothing wrong. You know that they understand things a lot better than you. They have a lot more experience. So if they're okay, everything must be okay, despite whatever emotions you might be experiencing. You distrust your emotions and look at that person. What you don't want to see is a flight attendant running up and down the aisle screaming, "We're all going to die." If that happens, you're in trouble. I'm sorry. It's over. And that is the point that Jesus is doing in our text. Do you really think it's a coincidence that he chose to take a moment, to take a nap in this moment, that he chose this moment to take a nap? Do you really think it's a coincidence? Nowhere else in the Gospels do we see Jesus asleep. It just so happens that the moment his disciples are facing their greatest fear, it's the greatest fear for a fisherman, to be caught out in the middle of a storm and drown. In the moment of their greatest fear, that's the only time we're told Jesus is asleep. You think that's a coincidence? I think it's intentional, and it's safe to assume that he is trying to communicate something to them and communicate something to us. He does not fear your greatest fear. Lord, wake up. Do you not care that we are perishing here? You're not perishing. That's the point. Now let me go back to sleep. And to the hurting, I want to humbly, with all sensitivity and understanding, I want to ask you to consider your trials from his perspective, not yours. I don't want to minimize your suffering, and I don't want to mock your pain. I know it's very real. But I do want to challenge your perspective. Maybe God's silence, as you view it, or his apparent inactivity, maybe that is not because he doesn't care about you. Maybe he knows you're going to be okay. Maybe he sees the whole story. Maybe storms don't scare him like they scare you, because he's bigger than the storm. Maybe for reasons that belong to the Trinity alone, the divine counsel alone, maybe he has placed you in the storm and has ordained a time to take you out of the storm, but that time's not now. Maybe he's not frantic, he's sovereign. So sovereign that what seems like a storm to you, he views as a good time to catch up on some sleep. And so sovereign that he can and he will, Christian, calm the storm. Continue on, verse 39. He awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. Now, clearly, verse 39 is what the hurting among us long for. Verse 39 is what the suffering want. We cry out for the day when the wind will cease and there will be great calm. And God does indeed promise that day will come. And that's a good application for the text. The day will come. He is sovereign and he will stop it. But that doesn't mean that you won't go through the storm. He doesn't promise there will be no storms. He does promise the storms will cease. He doesn't promise there will be no weeping. He does promise that joy will come in the morning. He doesn't promise a life void of trials. In fact, he promises the opposite, especially for the Christian. It's signing up for a hard life. But he does promise the trials will come to an end. For God's people, there are limits to suffering and there are boundaries to grief. It's temporary. It is a momentary affliction, is the way the Bible describes it, that will give way to eternal peace. Now, listen, it's at this point that we move into the arena of faith. Are you going to rely upon your interpretation of the storm, or are you going to trust Jesus' interpretation? You think this is your worst nightmare, or you imagine that thing as being your worst nightmare. He doesn't. You think this is inescapable. He doesn't. You think this will never come to an end. He doesn't. You think this is irredeemable. He doesn't. Whom will you believe? Jesus or yourself? And that's where Jesus takes us. Look at verse 40. Why are you afraid? Have you still no faith? Faith. He takes us to faith, to trust. We suffer by faith. At some point, we're just going to have to believe Jesus more than our circumstances. At some point, we're just going to have to say, I believe this book more than I believe my circumstances. Now, that's not naive, blind faith, by the way. He says, notice what he said, the nuanced way he said it. Have you still no faith? Now, why did he say, have you still no faith? Well, because this isn't the first time Jesus has demonstrated his faithfulness or his goodness. He has given them every reason to believe that he is good and worthy to be trusted. And he's done it for us too. In the storm, we tend to forget the days of his faithfulness. We forget the days we just wake up and go about our days and go to bed and he provides and he cares. We forget that all of our previous trials have been for our good. We see their goodness on this side of them. We forget these things. And that's why he says, have you still no faith? So we trust him. We choose to suffer by faith. Okay, so that makes a neat, tidy sermon. You got the storm, you got Jesus in the storm, calming the storm, and we trust him. Let's sing and go home, right? Well, that's not the end of the passage. What if I told you that we haven't even addressed their greatest fear? The disciples now have a much bigger problem on their hands, something infinitely more dangerous than the storm, and they realize it. They recognize it, and we need to as well. We've seen what they thought was their greatest fear. Let's look at what truly is their greatest fear. That last verse, 41. And they were filled with great fear. The Greek there, the original language there is very extreme. And the ESV tries to interpret it by saying great fear. I like the NIV. If you're using that, it says they were terrified. Now, what are they scared of? I thought the storm has been calmed. Well, it has. But now they're struck with the reality of the true storm. They were filled with great fear, and it says, they said to one another, who is this? Who then is this that the wind and the waves obey his voice? The passage began with the disciples fearing the storm, and it ends with them fearing the one who commands the storm. And you know what? They're right. They're right to do so. Their fears have been properly reordered. Who is this man? He commands the forces of nature, and the forces of nature obey him. And we just had the audacity to yell at him and accuse him, doubt him, and question his goodness. What have we done? This is an Isaiah 6 moment, if you're familiar with Isaiah 6. The prophet encounters the fullness of the holiness of God, an unveiled look into the glory of God. And it was a violent occasion for Isaiah. He was struck with just almighty terror. And all he knows to do is cry out, woe is me. And that's exactly what's happening in this passage. This act of power has unveiled this Jesus. And suddenly the disciples realize holiness is in their boat. And they just yelled at him. Verse 41 is essentially the disciples saying, we've got a bigger problem on our hand. A much bigger problem. We have insulted Almighty God. What's he going to do with us? And then the text just ends. Close Mark 4, on to Mark 5. This lingering question of reverence and awe and fear. Who is this? And the story's over. But it's not over is the point, of course. Jesus relieved the fears of the storm. That was easy. That took a couple words. Quiet, be still. And their storm was over. But now they have a much bigger storm to face. And Jesus intends to relieve that as well. But it's going to take more than a few words. This will not be easy. Do you understand how costly his kindness is? Do you even see his kindness? Do you see his kindness in the text? Look at verse 38 again. They woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" So insolent. Do you not care? Oh, do I not care? I was on the throne of heaven and now I'm sitting in your boat as a man. Yes, I care. But they accuse him. Do you not care? Our fears are so insulting. Verse 39. You want to see his kindness? And he awoke and rebuked the wind. In a rebuke, his entitled, disrespectful disciples, he yelled at the wind. They deserve the rebuke. They deserve more than a rebuke. Instead, he takes it out on the wind and the sea. Now look, Jesus is very patient with our doubts. There's room to struggle with God in suffering. He's very patient with our accusations and our questionings and our indictments, our distrust of him. God is patient with all of these things, but you do understand that he shouldn't be. He is kind to sinners like us, but that kindness comes with a price. Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? Oh, the irony of those words. He has come to rescue them from their perishing. But it's a much deeper and dangerous perishing than they know. You remember how I said that Jesus was asleep during the storm, not because he was indifferent, but because to him, he just didn't fear the storm. He's just totally at peace. I want to peek ahead to Mark 14. We're going to see a different disposition of Jesus. This is Gethsemane, just before his betrayal and execution. This is the end of this story. Verse 32. They went to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." And he took with him Peter and James and John, and he began to be greatly distressed and troubled. Now, this is the one who takes naps during storms. He is greatly distressed and troubled. What could this storm be? He said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death." You know that? I'm scared to death. "Remain here and watch." Going a little further, he fell on the ground and he prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. Now he's the one crying out. He said, "Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me." Yet, now he suffers by faith. He suffers with trust. "Yet not what I will, but you will." Verse 37. And he came and found them sleeping. The one who sleeps in peace during the storm, it says in verse 33, is greatly distressed and troubled. Now, what could make the one who commands the winds and the waves be distressed and troubled? He is about to save his people from perishing. He cares that they're about to perish. He's about to drink down that cup that he asked to not have to drink. The cup of God's fury. He will swallow down the wrath of God towards sinners like me. He is about to endure the true greatest nightmare. And the disciples who screamed and cried at a little storm, who yelled at him, "Don't you care that we're perishing?" Those same disciples are now asleep. They freak out and Jesus sleeps during the storm. Jesus is distressed and they sleep during the true storm. That's our story. After I got Charlie calmed down from this vacuum, I took the boys on a walk. I took them out to the park. They want to go outside. We're playing on the playground for a while, and then they want to go on a walk. And so Holt and Charlie went on ahead of me while I put Owen in the stroller and buckled him in and everything. And so they went out a little bit ahead of me, and they rounded this corner where just for a few moments they were out of sight. And then I finally caught up to them, and I find, you know, of course, my obedient firstborn Holt sitting there waiting for me, and no Charlie, of course. So this happens often, so I didn't freak out at first. I just kind of looked around and called out for him, and he's not answering. And it quickly starts to escalate. I can't find him. And so it turned into me running around the park, yelling out his name at the top of my lungs. And this goes on for what seems like an eternity. And then out of nowhere, I hear this casual, nonchalant, "Oh, here I am." And he comes down. He'd been up at the pool, which, you know, it's a great place for a kid to play. So there's a neighborhood pool, and he's somehow gone up to play there without a care in the world. And I grab him, and I get down in his face, and I say to him, "Listen to me, son. Do not leave your daddy. You don't understand how dangerous it is to leave me. Trying, as I have done so many times, my best to communicate in some way just how scary it is to run off by yourself as a 2-year-old. But he doesn't see it. The only thing he fears is a vacuum cleaner." Listen, I would like to ask you a question, perhaps the most personal question somebody can ask you. What is your greatest fear? What is your nightmare? Would it be the loss of a spouse or a child? Or the infidelity of a spouse, or the wayward rebellion of a child? Would it be never finding a spouse, never conceiving a child? Be cancer, financial ruin, losing it all? What is your worst nightmare? Some of you might say, "I'm living it right now." I don't know what your answer to that is, but let me tell you what your answer should be: the rejection of Almighty God. To hear those dreadful eternal words, "Depart from me, I never knew you." Face to face with holiness is your greatest nightmare. And to give an account for a lifetime of insults against God, that's your greatest fear. And if so, what I can offer you this morning as a minister of the gospel of Jesus Christ, if you have trusted in him, your worst nightmare will never come true. You will never experience your greatest fear. I cannot promise you that harm will not come to you or a loved one. I cannot promise you a happy marriage. Cannot promise you an easy home life. I cannot promise you that our economy won't collapse and every single one of us will lose everything. I can't promise you these things. I can promise you eternal peace with God. The tempest of his justice, the storm of his holiness, these have been appeased. There's nothing left for you, Christian. It is calm. It is still. The storm has been calmed. And it will be so forever. Now, perhaps the news that our greatest fear will never come true, perhaps that can transform the way we endure our lesser fears. I think that's the way it's supposed to work. The reason why we can go through the storms whenever they come, the reason why we can go through the storms saying it is well with my soul, is because it is truly well with my soul. My soul's fine. I'm okay with God. And I will be with him for all eternity. So we're going to sing that exact refrain. It is well with my soul.